Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Hello and welcome to Witch Please, a fortnightly podcast about the Harry Potter world. I'm Hannah McGregor.
And I'm Wolf Pesci.
And today I am bringing you what I have promised is going to be a long series of mini-sodes as Marcel and I patiently wait for J.K. Rowling to write some more books for us. The topic of today's mini-sode is book design. Now I know what you're thinking. We spend a chunk of time on every canonical book episode talking about, you know, the material culture of the print book, but we have consistently done so in a deeply unprofessional way. And today I'm actually joined by a new colleague of mine at my new job in Vancouver, who is actually a professional book designer and teaches book design in the publishing program that I'm working in now. And she's going to talk to us about, you know, like how book design actually works and maybe give us a bit of a vocabulary for talking and thinking about the different editions of Harry Potter. Something maybe a bit more sophisticated than that one time when I was on public radio and said, fuck tables of contents. I got in trouble. Uh-huh. Yeah, you're not supposed to say fuck on public radio, as it turns out.
Okay. Yeah. Can I say fuck now?
You sure can. We have an explicit rating on iTunes. This is a filthy podcast. Okay, so I have done something that will shock nobody. I have acquired 3 different copies of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which we have sitting in between us right now. I have, you know, my original copy, my Raincoast books, the classic Harry looking quizzically at the Hogwarts Express, and the Mystery Wizard on the back, which Marcel and I discussed so many years ago. And then I have acquired the new Bloomsbury paperback edition, partially so we can talk about the new covers, but also because this contains the paratext that Marcel is so, so angry about. And I have bought the Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone illustrated edition, illustrated by Jim Kay, you know, because that exists, and so let's talk about it. Let's start off with the original Raincoast. Can you start by talking a little bit about, like, as a book designer, when you look at a book cover, what you think about?
When I look at a book cover, what I usually will look at first is probably the type and then be really critical about it and think of all the ways that I would have made it better and be pretentious about it. And then I try to remember that there are many things to consider, not just your personal likes and dislikes, but actually audience, the purpose of the book, what you're trying to communicate, what the book is about, imagery, color, but mostly audience. But definitely then I start looking at type and look at the kerning of the letters. So the kerning would be the space between specific letters. So between, let's say, the H and the A and the A and the R and the R and R and the R and the Y. And then just look at that for a while and then be like, oh, look at the spacing between the P and the O compared to like the two T's. Like, why was it kerned like this? The two T's are so much closer together compared to the P-O-T.
Now that you're pointing it out, I am noticing that the way that Harry Potter is kerned looks really, really weird. Why would that be? Obviously, a professional book designer made this book.
Yeah, but sometimes you kind of, well, maybe forget. And also, I find that kerning will be not quite a personal decision, but how you visually interpret the spacing will vary from one person to another. It's finicky, finicky work.
So what else can you tell us about the cover of this Raincoast edition? When you look at this, what do you think?
I think that the illustration is not the best, but might be appropriate for, obviously, children. Yeah, I mean, it's a hardcover. Nothing very special about it. Matte dust jacket. There's no embossing. There's no spot gloss. There's no foil. And then the case itself is just a reprint. It's the same as the jacket, but more simple. There's no nice end papers, which is not uncommon for novels, obviously. Then I would just look at the type on the flaps. And what bothers me on the back flap is that there's an italic and then a bold italic. Yeah. And then they didn't have hanging quotation marks, which I find is a little sloppy. Oh my God, I'm being so critical. This is sad. Sorry, go ahead.
So now talk to us about the inside of this book. Like, what's the Raincoast edition like? I mean, it's hard to talk about because there's so little going on that it's almost like you're talking about the absence of something.
Which is important. Yeah. I think, like, one of them, you may know Beatrice Ward. She is the one who wrote The Crystal Goblet and talks about typography like a crystal goblet, where the crystal wine glass is supposed to be completely invisible so that you enjoy the wine. It's all about the wine. It is not about the glass. And so you want typography to be invisible and you don't notice anything about type because it can't be distracting. You want it to be all about the words and the story and the narrative, and so it shouldn't be about the design, especially for novels.
So this, you know, the thing I think that characterizes these Raincoast books is that they feel almost undesigned, which is like obviously intentional. And part of that might be that I've just naturalized them because they are a version that I am used to. But there is, you know, as Marcel has pointed out, there's very little paratext. So there are no illustrations, there's no map, there's no table of contents. There isn't much going on at the beginning of the chapters to mark them off. There's no shift in typeface between different sections. Like, there is, the chapters begin with a different font, and other than that, there's not much going on.
I think it might even be the same font, but just all caps, small caps, and then for the chapter, like chapter one, chapter two, and then the title is a larger typeface in italic, but it looks like the same serif as the text. So I think it's just like probably just one family the entire time. It's pretty basic. The thing that I find stands out the most here is just there's barely any margins. Mm-hmm. They're tiny and the leading is very tight. So
what's leading?
That's the space between baselines. And baselines is where
we're getting our technical vocabulary.
Baseline is the line where the type sits. So when I say leading, it's from the bottom of the letters, from one line to the bottom of the letters of the other line.
So is there anything you can tell about this book when you look at design aspects like this, about like how it was made or the considerations that they might have been making when they designed it this way?
Because of the small margins, because of the tight letting, they were trying to get as many words per page. mostly. And so it would be mostly economical reasons. The paper is kind of cheap. So it feels almost mass paperback with a hardcover.
Yeah, and yeah, so, it does feel pulpy, the paper. Yeah.
And so I think it would be economical at that point. And it's a decent, like the X height of the type size.
What's that?
Literally, it's the height of an X.
Oh, I see.
It's so complex. So a 10 point Times versus a 10 point Helvetica versus 10 point Georgia, let's say, or Verdana or whatever. The X height will be different based on each of the typefaces, even though it's the same technically type size. So they're all 10 point, but the X height will be different.
Just the X, or does the X indicate like the halfway mark for the lowercase letters? Or
not the halfway mark, but it is the standard for all the lowercase letter, that kind of like the N, your M, your A, your R are all going to be the same like as the X. Okay. Anything that goes above the X height is called an ascender, and everything below it would be a descender.
So like lowercase F is an ascender and a lowercase G is a descender?
Yes.
I'm learning a lot.
Yeah. And so when you have a big X height plus a tight letting, it just seems like it's tighter. So you could have the same letting here, but with a font that had a smaller X height, and it would seem more breathable. Okay. Yeah. So it's a little unfortunate that they picked a typeface that does have such a large X height. That being said, it's for kids, so it makes sense that it would use something a little larger because you want it to be legible and easy to read for kids. Yeah. So that's important.
So we've got a combination here of thinking about audience. So like a cover design that is bright and exciting for children, a font that is, you know, trying to be as big and readable as possible, and then considerations of the cost of production. So like wanting to minimize how much paper you use, the quality of paper, not too much fancy stuff happening in how the typesetting is executed inside the book.
Any of the other like production quality, like the fact that there's no end papers, that's also like cost saving. There's no ink on there. The fact that it's just like the same design for the case rather than something different or something with foil or a different kind of paper. Those are all just like pretty standard.
And I've got to say, this doesn't surprise me that much because these are, I mean, it's not a first edition, but it is the first version of this book. And when this book was designed, J.K. Rowling was not a celebrity and Harry Potter was not an international phenomenon. It was just another kid's book.
Yeah. Which also you can tell by her name being small. In some of the new editions, her name is gigantic because she's much more important. And that's one of the selling factors. It doesn't matter which book you're buying. It's her book.
Okay, so let's talk about these new Bloomsbury editions. So this is the ones that I have are not the copies that Marcel has been buying a few of. Those are the ones with the adult covers, which are the super, super brightly colored covers with the really sort of geometric, blocky type layout. But the insides are the same.
Weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. Oh, that's unfortunate.
So let's talk about this actual edition as a sort of a whole new set of design decisions for the same book. So first off, why entirely redesign a book that is iconic and has been selling in the same version for years?
That must be because of the audience is changing. And so they're trying to get new, younger kids, kids of today. And they will have different aesthetics. I mean, how old are the original?
1997.
That's a long time ago.
It's almost 20 years. Did you just suddenly feel really old? Because I know I did.
Oh my god. Because I remember when I actually started reading them. It was not when they came out. It was because I was way too cool as a teen to read Harry Potter.
Not me.
I was not cool, by the way.
Oh, I see. You were lying to me.
So I was way too cool.
Yeah.
And I obviously started reading them when I was in university. When I was even cooler. Where was I going with this?
Today's youth. I mean, this makes sense. I had a student a couple of years ago in a book history class who did a project on Gordon Corman. Do you know him? He's a Canadian YA author. And one thing that she did is do this presentation where she brought in like 3 or 4 different versions and asked her classmates what they thought. And the class unanimously preferred the most recent version because it spoke to their sensibilities. Yeah. Because the old ones, like, it was published originally in the 80s and it looks really dated.
Yeah.
So this does feel, this is pretty trendy.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, especially the illustration. Even without thinking about it in terms of being dated or not, I think the illustration is better, but it also has tendencies towards, I think, graphic novel, which is becoming more and more popular. And so it's not too surprising that they would go in that route. I also like the color palette. It's a bit more mysterious. So the title, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, is in foil.
I didn't touch it when I only bought it this afternoon. I hadn't touched it yet. Oh, so glossy.
Yeah, so it's raised and you can feel it on both sides. And on top of that, there's foil. Don't think there's a spot gloss on top of it. I think it's just the foil, which is shiny enough. And then all the little stars are also foil. It goes well with kind of any mystery type novels that would be very common. What I find strange is the typeface selection for Harry Potter. They moved away from both the original edition or the movie. I would have imagined that they would have gone with the movie because that one is so iconic.
It's the Harry Potter font.
Yeah. It is. And so I'm kind of really shocked that they didn't use it, and I wonder why.
I don't know, like, there is part of me that when I look at a cover that has the movie font, it feels a bit hackneyed. I don't want a Harry Potter movie tie-in edition.
And maybe they're trying to still go from a different audience as well, right? We need new people. And so let's find a really kid-friendly font.
This font is whimsical.
Like little distressed edges, like on, you know, the art. It's not like super clean, right?
Tell me about the matte. It's got this really weird matte finish to it.
Yeah, that's like the new matte trend. It's the no scuff matte, so that even if it scratches, it won't actually show. A lot of the older matte book would get kind of destroyed more easily, especially with dark colors. So if you had a black cover, it would really show if it was scuffed.
I remember going through piles of matte-covered books trying to find the one that didn't have fingernail marks down it yet.
Or oil. Oil shows a lot, too. And so this is a bit more resistant. I don't love the finish, but it is more durable, which is important for publishers because we know that the book publishing industry, you lend your book until they sell and they just return it to you. And so if they return all damaged, you can't sell those books. So you really need them to be durable.
That's a really good point. I think that this looks beautiful. Like, I think that the matte finish looks really nice. I hate the way it feels.
Yeah. Do you really, like, hate it? Like, you would not want to hold it while reading it? Or would you?
Only one way to find out. I feel irrationally strongly about things, though.
I used to quite hate it, maybe, like, a few years ago. No, not so much. I'm warmed up to it. I'm fine.
You're a hating, durable matte hipster. I hated this finish, like, 2 years ago, like, before anybody else hated it.
Told you I was super cool. Also interesting is the back cover. Can I take this sticker off?
She's removing the chapters sticker. You know what the key is to getting those stickers off? Lighter fluid. Takes that right off.
Wow. I wonder what else it can be used for.
Lighter fluid? Lighting things.
I mean, for cleaning.
I bet lighter fluid would get fingerprints off your walls. Only one way to find out. Let's just rub.
What do you know about my walls?
I assume they have fingerprints on them. FYI, Mauve has a child. That wasn't just me accusing her of being sticky fingered.
It's both, really. Okay, now that it's somewhat removed, it gives me a better sense of, like, the spacing. It's not as offensive now. Yeah, I find it interesting that the type is the fake gold.
So probably a Pantone, inspired by a Pantone. I don't think it would be a fifth color on here.
What is a Pantone?
Pantone is a color. It's a special ink, so it's their premix. So usually books are going to be printed in CMYK, which is cyan, magenta, yellow, CMYK, black. And every color can be made using those four inks. And so when you print in color, it's printing with four inks. It's with tons of little dots, and it gives full color, full spectrum, printed, obviously, spectrum, not digital. But when you need a very specific color, so let's say you are branding something, or you want a neon color, those will not be made through CMYK processes. You'll have a special fifth ink. So it's a fifth pass. So during the press, they'll run it through the press four times with the CMYK and then run it a fifth time. So it's a fifth plate. It's more expensive. So you'll have your metallic inks like that, your neons, and then any special, like Coca-Cola red. It needs to be that red. It can't be any kind of red. So they'll have a Pantone specifically to them. And so when I said Pantone, because it looks like a metallic-ish color, I would be mistaken, because I don't think they actually would pay for having a fifth color just for the back cover on top of having foil, which is another cost.
Yeah.
So they probably would just be inspired by a Pantone swatch. So they would look at all the swatch books, pick a kind of golden color to match with the foil that they have in the front and all the little stars in the back, and then just use a CMYK color of that. Oh, yeah, it's totally foil in the back. It's super shiny. Yeah. Yeah.
So magical.
Totally magical.
Okay, so let's talk about the inside. So much happening inside this book.
Yeah.
A busy book.
Turn the cover, and so that your inside cover has printing on it for color, so CMYK as well. And then what we see is that repetition of the little stars that were in foil on the cover are repeated on the inside front cover, on the reviews page, on the half title page, on the title page, as well as the like series information on the copyright page, on the dedication page, on the contents page. It's just like
a lot of stars.
Yeah, but it creates continuity, and especially some of these pages tend to be kind of boring. I actually love designing those pages because nobody pays attention to them, so you can go pretty wild without going like too wild, but you can have a lot of like little design elements that make it a little bit more interesting, and nobody cares, so you can be creative. You know, I like that they thought about putting things there that's not just the standard.
So let's talk about the first big content difference, which is table of contents. Do you have feelings about tables of contents?
I like them. But I really like lists. I think they're very useful, don't you?
Not in a novel. No, I don't think a novel needs tables of contents. Like, table of contents in a collection of essays or an academic work, absolutely. Because I am going to be moving around in that way in that book. But that's not how I move through a novel. And so I don't know what that's for, because I'm not going to read it. Like, I'm not going to open a novel and be like, let me read the table of contents and discover what the chapter titles are.
What if you weren't using a bookmark and you weren't dog-earing your pages?
But I am using a bookmark or dog-earing my pages.
Your bookmark fell, but you remember the title of the chapter.
Then I will just flip through the book until I get to it again.
Well.
Yeah, no, I absolutely see that point. It's interesting because I feel like a table of contents is something that sort of starts making sense after you have read the book once. Like, you don't need it on your first read through, but when you're re-encountering it, you might say like, I love this one scene, I'm gonna go back and reread that. And it reminds me of the fact that in a lot of early magazines, the table of contents for the magazine came at the end.
I think actually some European books also still have a table of contents at the end, as well as copyright information is at the end, because it is considered not necessary, and you want to enter the text immediately rather than go through kind of the you know, front matter. Like, why bother?
Yeah, I kind of like that because it's like table of contents. That's like my index.
Yeah,
an index, a glossary, that kind of more additional information. I could also see putting the map in the back. That would make sense. Yeah. Or even using it as end papers.
Yeah. Okay, so map. I love maps too. I have some feelings about this map, and my feelings are based entirely on my experience of reading the Harry Potter books as a child, and the fact that as you read through the books, you slowly discover the world of Hogwarts. So you don't get to go to Hogsmeade until the third book. So you don't know where Hogsmeade is in relation to it. And so the world of Hogwarts opens up to you as it opens up for Harry, specifically as our narrator. And there's something about having this map at the beginning that makes me feel like, well, no, but you're not allowed to know about Hogsmeade yet. You're only in first year. But I am torn because I love a map. This map is beautiful. And I particularly love fantasy novels having maps.
Yeah, I really do love maps. I think that it might be because I'm a visual person. I find that it always helps me situate things, have a better understanding of like distance and difficulty, especially if they're traveling somewhere. Things in relations to other things, I think, are important. So I do really like the map. I think this map is awesome, too. The banners are all different and illustrated, and those are lovely. I like this beast in the water. What you said, though, about having too much information, I think is very interesting. And maybe what they could have done is the same thing as the Game of Thrones, which they only have the map that's relevant to that story. And then as you progress and go to the other worlds, then you see more of the map. And even now, like on the internet, you have people speculating about the map because he hasn't finished writing the book. So it's still like, there's a lot of like map drawing speculations, which I find so awesome about like where things are. So maybe they could have done something like that and just been more conservative in what they were showing.
I love that idea of having a different map for each one of the books that shows us a representation of the world as it exists in that book. Yeah, exactly. And it would expand with each book because his world expands. But that's not what they've done. It's the same map in every edition. You should design books.
Yeah, I should. It was so much cheaper to not do that, though. Having one map designed, so much easier.
And like you said, this map is really stunning.
Yeah.
Does it feel... So I have pulled up on my laptop here the original map of Middle Earth from Lord of the Rings, which I feel like is the secret intertext in every fantasy novel's map. You are always speaking back to this map when you design a map at the beginning of a fantasy novel.
Interesting. Yeah. I've never actually read those books.
Oh, they're very boring. Sorry, guys. I'm not. They're boring. I read 2.5 of them. The third one, I couldn't. But it's interesting to me to think about like how you were always playing off it. And so what are the sort of expectations of the way that this map is going to look? And then how have you subverted it?
Don't you think it just looks like a historical map, though? And so its influence is looking at actual historical maps?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. But it's a particular period. Yeah. And then, like, there are so many different ways that maps could look. So why does this map look so much like this one when it could look so different? I think we have a sort of genre of the fantasy novel map in our heads. It is absolutely based in historical maps. But I think that comes from Lord of the Rings using that.
Interesting. Yeah, because at the same time, you could have asked the same illustrator than the cover to do a rendition of the map, and that would have probably looked very different, more cartoony. That would kind of look cool too, probably.
Yeah.
But that's like, this says I'm a map.
It also says to me, like, I'm a fantasy novel.
I guess for me, I see it more as something historical. Mm. So it's supposed to be like, it's old, there's history, there's like, in terms of the wizard history, I mean, with the banners especially.
Mm-hmm. I was about to say incorrectly that there is nothing on here that dates it to the time of Harry's presence, that it's a sort of timeless Hogwarts map, but that is a lie because of Hagrid's hut.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about the typeface choices in this edition.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey folks, Hannah here. I'm jumping into your feed before today's episode to let you know that I have a brand new YouTube show called Making Worlds. Monthly episodes are released on our Witch Please Productions Patreon, and they are an absolute hoot. Every episode, I am joined by a cool guest to talk about a sci-fi or fantasy text that has inspired them to move differently in the world and to imagine otherwise. Our first episode was about Our Flag Means Death, and our second episode is about Dimension 20. I am a huge nerd about both of those franchises, so as you can imagine, I had the time of my life. You can watch the episodes or listen to them as a podcast right now by becoming a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/awitchplease. You'll also get access to a backlog of many other perks. Again, head to patreon.com/awitchplease to become a supporter today for as little as $5 a month.
Well, they are using more than one typeface this time. You have two, at least, in terms of your typical text typefaces. There is one that is distressed that's both used for, let's say, chapter 1, 2, and 3, blah, blah, blah. It's like a very slightly distressed.
You know, compared to looking at the first one, which was so simple, mm-hmm. there seems to be more happening here.
You briefly mentioned earlier all the different typefaces. So on page 55, they switch typefaces and it's just it looks like an older font. It actually, what it looks like it's been photocopied. But it's not. It looks like it's an old book that would have been either photocopied and then reprinted, or they had the plates back in the day and then just printed from those old plates. Mm-hmm. You have sometimes books like that where they'll just throw in a new cover, but like the printers or the publisher doesn't have the digital files and they just use this like old technology and it just feels different. The fonts are not actually distressed. It's just because of the technology that the lines are not as sharp as they would be.
The document that's being produced on the page here is the letter that Harry has received from Hogwarts inviting him. And they have realistically created the feel of an older medium being reproduced here.
And then you have the signature, like a fake signature, so in a kind of a script font, and then also a handwritten note. Well, I mean, it's a type, but it's a digitized handwritten font. I think that this change of typefaces is completely appropriate for the audience. Mm-hmm. I think it breaks up the text and it makes it a little bit more inviting. It's kind of replacing illustration. So for a text that does not have illustration, it's not an illustrated book. It acts as a bit of an illustration, but still provides content. So I tend to like them.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like it's jarring when the version of the book that you have read is the first one. But one of the things that's interesting to me about encountering these kinds of choices is that it's then a reminder that first book is not neutral. It's also a set of choices. Mm-hmm. Like the choices that they have made are to not do this kind of stuff. Yeah. We had an interaction once with one of our lovely listeners who said that the original American editions had a lot of this, maybe not the same, but like a version of this kind of paratext in it from day one. And he suggested that the Raincoast books were this sort of Canadian puritanical aesthetic.
I had just assumed that the Canadian Raincoast edition was the files from the original publisher,
which would have been British.
Yeah,
Canadian is the same as the British. Okay. But I think the American were different.
Interesting. Because it would be much cheaper to do that, because you just get the InDesign files, or I'm assuming it would have been InDesign at the 97? Maybe not. PageMaker? Quark. It probably was Quark. Quark Express files sent by the publisher in the UK, and then they would have just used that. And maybe changed, like, some spelling, but probably not, because it's British and we're Canadian, so boom, done.
Yeah, like, we didn't change them. I know they changed words in the original US edition, you know, to get rid of British words that American readers wouldn't know.
Yeah, kids will have a harder time with different words, so of course.
Yeah, I will have to follow up with Adam about what those original American editions looked like, but... Yeah, I don't know. Like, when Marcel first brought one of these to my attention, I was like, this is a bit much. But when I was looking through them at the bookstore today, I was pretty convinced. Like, they're really fun.
I think they are fun. There's not that many, so I don't find that they're too overwhelming. They're not, like, too distracting. It just adds a little fun thing here and there. Yeah. And in terms of just, like, the general look of this book, it's so much better. The leading here is much more readable. There's more breathing room. The margins are nicer. The typeface selection is nicer. The X height is more appropriate with the leading. So it's just a little bit easier to read.
There's more in some of the later books, because some of the later books include, like, for example, really large excerpts from books that Harry is reading, and those will all be set aside with a different type. But again, I didn't find them obnoxious, because it's just like these three pages are just in a different type.
And I guess it would depend also if it's like three pages of fake handwritten or cursive would be very different than three pages of a different serif that seems a little bolder. Like, if it was every single page or every single spread had something and it was a crazy font, I'd be like, okay, like, let's give me a break now. Give me a break. It's supposed to be like, it's supposed to be legible.
Speaking of editions that do or do not calm down, let's finish by talking about the illustrated edition. So these are the big hardcover Jim Kay illustrated editions that are being slowly released. Only Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone is out so far. Chamber of Secrets is now forthcoming. And we briefly consulted the Bloomsbury website and realized two things. One is that you can now buy Chamber of Secrets or a Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets box set, which is amazing, assuming they will release a new box set with every new book that they bring out. And also that, so I have the illustrated edition, but there's also a deluxe illustrated edition. So they're really just amping that up. And I'm guessing we can't look inside the deluxe illustrated edition, but my guess is that they're the same inside, and that it's the cover design that's different.
Based on the tiny thumbnail on the website, it did look like the case was different. So this hardcover has a jacket with an illustration. You open it up. The case is red. Oh, what would you say? What is it? It's not fabric, or, I mean, it's like, it's paper, but it's imitating...
It's like attempting to imitate, like, it's got a sort of faux fabric finish to the to the paper.
Laid, by the way.
What does that mean?
It's that pattern. It's pressed like that.
Oh, it's pressed to look like it has the weave of a fabric, exactly, with the horizontal and vertical lines.
Yeah.
My guess is that the deluxe edition is fabric.
Definitely had tons of foil on the cover, and maybe on the back, not just on the spine like your edition.
Yeah. And it had a fancy looking box that also had embossing all over it. This one is still pretty fancy.
It looks beautiful. I really like the illustrations. I especially like the end papers. Mm-hmm. The typesetting is nice. I mean, there's things here and there that I'm like, oh, they really could have fixed that.
Like this.
You have a widow.
Okay, we are currently looking, just in case anybody has this at home, looking at an unnumbered page. Page 13, we have the illustration at the top of Hagrid on his flying motorbike, and Mauve has spotted a widow. What's a widow?
It's the last line of a paragraph that starts at the top of a new column. So it creates this weird gap right at the beginning of the column.
That's like a typesetting faux pas.
It's a big no-no. But sometimes they're just so hard sometimes to avoid. Ideally, you would want the last line of your paragraph to be at least half of the paragraph width. That is really hard when you have especially like a one sentence paragraph. So then you can tweak the spacing between letters and words to try to make it fit, play with hyphenation, but sometimes it just doesn't work.
And there's a lot of complexities to the design of this book, because for those of you who haven't looked at it, it's not, you know, a page of type and then a full page illustration beside it. There are some examples of that, but for the most part, it's illustrations incorporated onto the actual page with the type sort of sharing the space with the illustrations, moving around the illustrations. So from page to page, the layout is constantly different and the relationship between image and text keeps changing. And even on pages that are just text and don't include illustrations, every page is a painting, and it's, you know, like watercolor paintings that have been done to look like old paper with like some ink blots on some of them. And it doesn't, I mean, I would have to look much more carefully, but it doesn't even look like they've just taken one version of that and reproduced it page to page. They look different.
I'm sure they have a certain number of them, and then they could use them like a different orientation to just have some variety. I can't even imagine the file size of this book. It must have been so, like, gigabytes and gigabytes. It must be huge, because every page has an image that's full size. It's not just a little insert. So that's more than some of the cookbooks that I've done. It's just that's huge. And the planning for this was probably quite extensive. So they would have done a flat plan probably at the beginning of production, even before designing, before selecting typefaces, before doing all of that. They would have planned what illustration they wanted, if it was going to be full bleed or not, if it was going to be an insert, if it was going to be you know, like half page. That's a lot of planning. It's a lot of work.
So this is the spread of pages 4 to 5, and it's a big, beautiful picture of an owl looking you straight in the face. And what's remarkable about it is that it is like a full page painting, but there's still typo over it. So talk about what the challenges of that would be.
Legibility. So I was wondering how that was, I guess, done, or what was the thought processed. My suspicion is that the artist did the painting, and then when they put the type on there, it was a little bit hard to read, and so then the designer probably would have put a white gradient so that it would be easier to read the black type, but at the same time where the transparency would be, leave the original painting quite saturated, because right now when we look at it, the head is quite detailed, saturated, while the body and especially the wings and the tail is quite washed off. And so it looks like it could have done some manipulation to make sure that it's readable.
The thing that really struck me the first time I looked through this is just like, these people have presented themselves with a new challenge on every page. Like, you could have reproduced more of the same thing and still had it look beautiful, but it feels like it keeps mixing up the relation between image and text in a way that makes it really exciting to look through. It keeps doing unexpected things.
In some ways, it's kind of using what a magazine designer would do. Magazines are much more complex than books, and you know, you have different features that will change every issue, and you just deal with it. And this is kind of like that, where every spread is different, just like a magazine print, and it just, they present variety, and this is kind of doing that. I mean, it doesn't look like a magazine by any means, but the...
Oh, it does have columns.
Yeah.
Like magazines do.
True. Yeah. And some books.
Nope, no books have ever had columns.
So. Right, yes. Right. I'm learning a lot about book design today. So on page 25, there is a widow. It's like a widow paragraph as well. Yeah. It's a little sad, but in terms of word count, it would have fit if it wasn't for that big snake.
Yeah. That was a really good sentence.
I always say that.
Yeah. I mean, that's just a really fun thing to be able to say about the layout of a page. Yeah, I tried to make all the type fit, but there's this damn snake in the way.
That snake really creates some problems.
But it also creates some, like, fun movement in the text. Oh, shit, yeah.
The snake is creating rivers.
What's a river?
Rivers are the white spaces. So when you have justified text, if the column is quite narrow, it's going to just create these huge gaps between words just because it's trying to keep the justification, you know, going. So if you have too many of these huge gaps, it's going to create what you call rivers, because like a river could run through the text essentially. And that's because the snake is really encroaching onto the column, and so making the essentially the column quite narrow, and the narrower the column, the harder it is to put words in. That snake, man. It's ruining everything for the book and the people.
Interesting how much
of the splotchiness there is, eh? Like there's the small splotches throughout, and then there's like also as kind of background splotchiness for inset illustrations.
There's an intense watercolor aesthetic being used here, though I think that the representation of ink is also in keeping with the Wizarding World, because they write in ink, right? Yeah. Like that's, they write with quills and ink, so that also gives us a sense of that material old-timiness of the Wizarding World. Like they use scrolls and ink and quills inexplicably. And a lot of this book is just like, the way this book's been designed is just like, that feels old-timey, a bunch of ink splotches,
which is really crappy craftsmanship.
That idea of like poor craftsmanship being conflated with old-timiness reminds me of something I was told at a letterpress workshop that I went to, where the printer was talking about the aesthetic of old-timey printing, particularly like a feel that we associate with like circus notices, which is a lot of spotting inside the type. Yeah. And she was talking about how like those would be like a really, really cheap sort of runoff rapidly when a circus arrived in town, because they would just want to, you know, whip up a bunch of bulletins and circulate them without caring about the quality. But that now has this sort of nostalgic association of it, even though it's actually an indication of poor craftsmanship.
Of course. Even right now, it's also very fashionable with letterpress to have the texture, so that the letter pressed really hard into the paper, so it creates an impression, so it's, you know, embossed. Yeah. That would be absolutely not the way to do it. It's not actually supposed to leave any marks.
It makes sense. It is bad printing if in the process of printing one side of the page, you ruin the other side of the page.
That is correct. It just looks really cool for business cards.
Tell me about like the use value of a book like this, because what strikes me about this book is it is so big. It is so heavy. The pages are so large. You are not going to carry this book with you. You are not going to take this anywhere. You are not going to read it on a plane or a train or a bus. You might struggle to read it in bed. Is this the version that somebody is using to actually read this book?
I could see like a parent reading to a child, because two people need to hold it. I think this is a coffee table book, essentially. So it is a art piece. It's not a mass paperback. It's not a digital version. So I think in design, in publishing right now, we see a trend. People can get their books in so many different formats for very cheaply. How are we going to make them buy books that are printed? You're going to have to make really special editions so that it's worth it. And then you spend more money on it. The readers are spending more money on it. It becomes art pieces. So I think it's like the gift market coffee table book. It's like, it's a collector's. I've worked a lot in cookbooks, and I do think a lot about who buys cookbooks, because even as a cookbook designer, cookbook lover, I get a lot of my recipes online. When I'm just looking for a random thing to do or an idea, I go online. I don't really go through my cookbooks.
But I love buying cookbooks. I love looking at cookbooks. I love looking at the photos. It's more for collection of them, if they're pretty, if the photography is nice, and inspiring, rather than practical.
Yeah. And they are also, your cookbook collection is another way in which you accrue books in order to make a statement about yourself as a person, right? Especially because cookbooks align with different lifestyles in such particular ways, so that you can, you know, a display of a particular kind of cookbook is a way of very clearly framing your own identity as well.
Yeah. Now I'm trying to think what my cookbooks say about me. Oh my God.
But I bet they say something about you, right? Like, if you went into my kitchen right now and looked at my cookbooks, you'd be able to figure out a couple of important things really quickly. One, they're all vegan. Cookbooks do a really good job of indicating to us that books do not just exist for reading, because if books were just about content and the turn to the digital was just about taking that content and putting it in a different format, then cooking blogs would have replaced cookbooks years ago. Yeah. And they haven't. Yeah. So that indicates to us that books serve a different function than simply communicating content to us.
Yeah. Especially since the internet is actually a really good way to learn how to cook and do recipes, like with the amount of photos that they have and videos. It's amazing. Yeah. So it would be like, it's completely ridiculous to just look at cookbooks to learn how to cook.
Yeah, it's not a good way to do it.
No, that's sad.
Yeah. And similarly, this book is maybe not a great way to read Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. But I don't at all regret the fact that I own it. I think it's absolutely stunning.
There's a couple of things that I don't like about it. Yeah. Do you want to know what they are?
Yes, very much so.
I'm a little disappointed that the chapter openers are half pages. Chapter openers are often the time to kind of do a big splash, to be like, we're in a new section, look at us. And here,
it's pretty much always a half page illustration with the chapter title incorporated into the center of it, and then half a page of type at the bottom.
And I feel they could have done something a little bit more flamboyant and grandiose.
When I sat down with this book, like, I bought it and I brought it home and I sat down with it and I was like, okay, what can I say about this? And I was like, well, it's very pretty. It's like, I don't even know where to begin to talk about the kinds of very specific decisions that go into designing something like this. Any final thoughts on Harry Potter book design? You were just about to say something else nitpicky, weren't you?
Yeah, just about the font. We didn't really talk about the cover.
The cover, which is blue foil
with also being embossed, which is more appropriate, I think, to the new kids Bloomsbury edition, which had that with the gold foil. But I think that worked better with that kind of genre, like the mystery type novel. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that it was necessary here. I don't think, like, everything else was finely crafted, attention to detail, and this seems a little cheap. You see that kind of stuff most for, like, mass market books, not for huge editions. I mean, you do see it, but maybe it's, like, the fact that it's both the embossing and the foil. It's just a little too much for me.
It's interesting to see the lengths they have gone to try to produce luxury editions, right?
Yeah.
Why don't we finish with you telling me how you feel about the kerning on this cover? We can come full circle.
It's better than the first one. Yeah. Except they also have, like, weird letter spacing for the Philosopher's Stone. Lowercase do not need letter spacing. And it looks like the reason they have it is to make room for a drop shadow. And again, you don't really need the drop shadow because you're actually
using, what's the drop shadow?
It's that, like, little black that's next to the blue to create even more depth.
Which you really don't need when you're also embossing and foiling.
Exactly.
That is overkill.
What I do like, though, is how much the owl stands out.
Like, makes perfect sense because Hedwig is the secret star of the Harry Potter series. Hedwig will live forever. All right. Amazing. Thank you. Shit, it's not Hedwig. Oh my god, cancel everything. Who's this fucking owl? Thanks, dear listeners, for joining us for episode 15.5, probably, of Witch Please. The rest of our episodes are, as always, available at owitchplease.ca. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever platform you prefer. Speaking of iTunes, special shout out to Cyclone Chloe for leaving us a review. Be cool like Chloe and leave us one too. That was a poem. And speaking of cool things to do, don't forget to check out our merch at society6.com/owitchplease or through the link on our website. Thanks, of course, to our special guest, Mauve Paget. If you would like to see some of Mauve's design work, you can go to pageanddesign.com and check out some of the books that she's worked on. Special thanks, as always, to Trevor Chow Fraser, our erstwhile tech support and the robot of our hearts.
Hi, how are you doing?
And kisses to everyone whose name would have shown up on the Twitter list if I was doing one for this minisode. You know who you are. We'll be back next episode with another minisode of Marcel's devising. But until then, later, witches.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.